Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled Getting to Know the European Union, Austria. Speaking will be Dr. Wolfgang Rennesetter, Director of the Austrian Press and Information Service at the Embassy of Austria. Moderating tonight's discussion is Alan Berger, Senior Editorial Writer for the Boston Globe. We begin with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
We are very happy to talk about Austria because perhaps you know that our mother institution, the original Institute for Human Sciences, is located in Vienna and has been founded 25 years ago. It has been created in the old times of Cold War. At that moment, it seemed that Vienna was a perfect place in between Eastern Europe and Western Europe, and a great place to mediate between these two divisions. And this is why some of our colleagues, Krzysztof Michalski, who came from Poland, and two of his friends from Germany, Cornelia Klinger and Klaus Nellen, went to Vienna, especially chose that city and created that institute, which, among other things, in 2001, inspired the Boston University to create this very institution which is hosting you today. Thank you very much for coming. And this is Dr. Wolfgang Rennesetter, who is the director of the Austrian Press and Information Service at the embassy, a position he has held since October 2006. And previously, he was first secretary for political and economic affairs at the Austrian embassy in Moscow. And he has experience in talking about Austria and about European Union, and we therefore are very interested in listening what he has to say. We are going to have the usual format. The evening is going to be moderated by Alan Berger, the senior editorial writer for the Boston Globe, as usual, as all of our evenings in the series of Getting to Know European Union. So please, Dr. Rosenberg.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this kind words, and thank you very much for providing me the opportunity to speak a little bit about Austria's experience as a EU member state, and the implications we have witnessed since we became members of the European Union. I think this experience of a member state like Austria, we joined the EU in 1995. Is a very particular one because in 1994 there was a referendum on being a EU member country. The approval was 67%, which is quite high. And in particular, if you see how the discussion is taking place today and in the previous years on the EU reform treaty, and there were two referenda in two EU member countries that were negative and that finally led to a renegotiation of this EU constitution or EU reform treaty. This shows that there is also quite a lot of skepticism in Europe as to the European Union, as to the benefits of the European Union, as to the services of the European Union. Austria would say, and if you look into the opinion polls, is still and still remains firmly to its membership in the European Union. In particular, the young generation, and this is what I would like to explain in the following, feels and sees very much the benefits of the European Union. In fact, Austria's EU membership, I would say, is a success story. If we look into the new trade opportunities, and this is what I would like to explain in the following. What happened is that since we became a member of the European Union in 1995, there was a rising economic growth, there were rising foreign direct investments, and there was a rising trade exchange. If we take the fact that 7% of the world population lives in the EU, but 19% of imports and exports worldwide take place within this space of the European Union, this shows that this is a very a very active space, and this has a lot of implications for a small or medium-sized country like Austria, and as exports and and imports were rising at this time significantly. Now we have a significantly higher trade exchange, in particular with those countries who are EU member states. 80% of our trade is with EU member states. So this gives us a very good understanding. And if you, I mean, I was assigned to Moscow before, and I know that those countries in Central and Eastern Europe are very interesting trade partners for us. But if you see how bureaucratic hurdles, how problems at the borders, how tariff problems can delay imports and exports and can cause a lot of costs, this is a significant factor that being in this single market, imports and exports are much more fluent with less additional costs, and it is possible to deliver just in time. So this, the consequence was, in fact, that exports and imports were rising. And secondly, foreign direct investments were rising. Austrian foreign direct investments abroad in the EU in particular, but in particular also in the new EU member states, and also vice versa, foreign investment, direct investment of EU member states in Austria. And this is what I would say is the most interesting aspect. We have traditionally very close ties to Central and Eastern Europe because once we were part of the same Austro-Hungarian Empire. And those countries like Hungary, like the Czech Republic, like Slovenia, those countries have really a very close relationship to us. And soon after the Iron Curtain fell, the Austrian investments went directly into those countries in several sectors, in the industry, in the telecommunication sector, but in particular also banks. And right now we have a situation that Austria has invested number one, for example, in Romania, in Slovenia, in Croatia. And in those countries, it is not only the Austrian investment that is appreciated and the trade exchange, it's also the Austrian expertise. And as a second consequence, companies like, for example, Coca-Cola, American companies, decided they wanted to establish their headquarters in Vienna and from Vienna a network with their affiliates in Central and Eastern Europe. Due to many reasons, and one of the main reasons, of course, that the central position of Vienna and the very good network of an infrastructure and the possibility to make use of all the expertise that can be provided by Austrian experts in regards to investing in those new member states and in the Western Balkans, etc. What happened is the foreign direct investments since then had a significant reached a significant number of $37 billion, and also the foreign direct investments in Austria. And what is I would say an interesting side effect is that that young people who were not as dynamic as they are now are making use of those scholarship programs, of those fellowship programs, of exchange programs, and of academic programs that that are part of the European Union and that are offered and provided not only in Europe but all over the world through the European Union. What is another interesting economic aspect, and if you visit Austria, it seems to you a very rich country, a wealthy country. But even Austrian regions that were not as developed as others received subsidies from the European Union and could improve very much in agriculture and rural development. The eastern province, Burgenland, for example, received quite a lot of subsidies, and I myself witnessed that there has been a great improvement in agriculture in these areas due to subsidies of the European Union. So this is really a very interesting side effect. We know it very well from Spain, from southern Spain. We know it very well from southern France. But even countries like Austria benefit from these funds that exist for exactly this purpose. And by fulfilling the very strict criteria, macroeconomic criteria, to become a member of the Eurozone, of this currency, the common currency, European currency, we had to also try to implement certain criteria as to our budget deficit, as to reducing the inflation rate. And this led us to improving also our macroeconomic standards and things that are also positive side effects for a EU member country that have really benefits. Now, to come back, what happened after the Iron Curtain fell, and this was a long process. I think that one of the benefits that a EU country has, like Hungary or the Czech Republic, is that those countries can develop very quickly with the help of Austria and other Western European countries. The industry, the infrastructure, the bank sector, etc. The second implication is, of course, immigration, and this is very, very much part of the discussion. What does this mean if in 2011 every European citizen can immigrate or can move to another country of the European Union and work there without any boundaries? This is a process of discussion that was accompanied, of course, with the discussion inside Austria and inside other Western European countries, inside Germany. What does this imply? Do we really have a need of more workers in many parts of the industry? And the very interesting side effect was that I think we noticed very often that there is a need of more. There's a need of workers, in particular the skilled workers. There, Austria is looking for some qualified, interested workers coming to Austria. And what is now part of the discussion is how will this be in the future? Which are the implications for the future? If in 2011 there will be no transition period anymore, and every European citizen has the possibility to move to another country, I think the overall success story is that economic figures show that it is a tremendous chance for Austria, for other European countries, and in particular, if we look at the enlargement and those new member states, it was a very interesting chance for them. It is a win-win situation. It is a very dynamic growth, and it led to a growing trade exchange, growing foreign direct investments, growing investments, and also, I would say, a closer political cooperation. And this is, I would say, the last point for me as a diplomat. What has been always very interesting is whenever we meet inside the European Union, we don't speak very much about European problems. I mean, the European problems exist. There are trade problems, there are economic problems, there are problems that have to be discussed inside the European Union. We have a very good instrument as to discussing it inside with the Commission, with the experts of the Commission and the Council. But what is coming afterwards is that most of the problems that we're discussing inside the European Union as diplomats are problems like the Middle East, are problems like Russia, are problems, energy problems in regard to Russia, are problems like, for example, China and human rights. And even Latin America or Africa or Asia, where Austria, as a medium-sized country, focused very much on this area. It doesn't really have too many diplomatic representations, so we make use of this network of diplomatic representations, missions of the European Commission. And on the other hand, we can provide our expertise, our advice to those who would like to know more as to what happens in the Western Balkans, because there we're very much present. There we have our historically very close ties, and there we are really very well informed and can provide useful information. So this is very much a part of this development, which is seen, I would say, by the generation that grew up with it, already is a part of Austria. Austria and Europe, this is not anymore as divided as it used to be. And my personal experience that when I grew up in Austria, I was born in 1974, and I grew up with the shilling, the Austrian currency. And this Austrian currency is something that is a very stable currency. It's a currency that is a little bit of a symbol of the reconstruction of Austria. We did a good job. My parents and grandparents' generation did a very good job in building up an economy after World War II. We're very grateful for the American assistance in the recovery program, through the Marshall Plan. This has been everything a symbol, and very much a symbol of all this is the Austrian shilling. And I grew up with this currency. And when the euro was introduced in 2002, I had to begin to get used to it. And I was still thinking, and I must say so far I'm still thinking, in the shilling. And I'm a little bit jealous when I see the very young people who grew up with the euro already and are calculating in the euro and are already used to it. So I think this is very much a part of the process that what we see today, what we perceive as European Union, is something that some of us see it, witness a process from the very beginning to nowadays, and some of them grew up with the European Union already existing part of the Austrian identity and the European identity. This leads me to the very last point, the reform treaty, because this has been a very high discussion. I suppose the other ambassadors spoke a little bit more about this. This was highly discussed in Brussels and in all the European capitals. What is going to be the future of the European Union? The European Union was established, or the European Community, in 1957. So we had the 50th anniversary this year, and it was a very small community consisting in that time of 6 member states. Right now we have 27 member states. You can imagine how many languages, and we have so many new challenges we have to face that certain reforms are necessary. And since I joined the diplomatic service, there has always been a discussion on how we're going to reform the European Union. By the way, there was also always a discussion on reforming the United Nations or the OSCE. But the one that the discussion was very, very emotional, or at least very active in Austria and in other European countries, was the future of the European Union, because the European Union is not an international organization where unanimous decisions are taken. This means that the Commission and the Council can, with a certain majority, take decisions that are implemented and are valid all over Europe, even if a country is not happy with it. In certain areas, there are unanimous decisions, like foreign security policy. But so this means to lose, or at least to take into account that part of the sovereignty goes to Brussels and is lost by the member state. Therefore, this discussion is quite emotional. What was, of course, a big surprise, because Austria also ratified this new constitution treaty that was negotiated and was ready practically in 2005, ratified this treaty, as did also other, I think, 18 member states. And then there were the 2 referenda in 2 countries that were traditionally very pro-European. And this led to a certain discussion inside Austria. And, of course, in Austria you have also a high number of Eurosceptical persons. And I had a lot of discussions with them, and in particular, I mean, some of the developments are already so fast that you really are not aware of where the competences of Brussels and where the competences of the member states and what is decided when and where. So a little bit of lack of transparency and a little bit of lack of, I would say, information for the public. Although there are many programs of information trying to bring about this information, but it has become so complicated, and those treaties are so long, and the substance is so complicated, that perhaps this might be one of the reasons why, in the end, whenever there is a discussion, everything is then blamed, the discussion ends up with the fact that that they see the. The main problem in Brussels and not in the fact that perhaps the problem could be solved at home. So I think this new reform treaty that has been negotiated, finalized on October 18th, it will be signed in Lisbon, is a very good approach because, first of all, there has been a sort of compromise. How will the institutions be reformed? A new legal identity also of the European Union. And I think a perspective of how the European Union will evolve and will continue to evolve in the future. And also, of course, with the perspective of future enlargements, because this was also a question, how can we enlarge the European Union, which has already 27 institutions, and the mechanisms are basically the same as in 1957. So this was also part of the discussion. And future enlargements, future developments, future integration is something that is now open and is very welcome and has to be discussed. And it goes without saying that this has to be discussed, of course, inside the European Union and with all member states and listening to all concerns of the EU citizens. I think basically these are most of the points. If there are questions and I would be happy to answer them.
There was a story that was in the news recently about a family of people from Kosovo. They were Albanian Kosovars who were refused citizenship in Austria. They'd been living there for 5 or 6 years working. They applied for citizenship. They had a 15-year-old girl in the family who had completely integrated. She spoke Austrian German with the accent of the village she lived in.
Yeah, in Austria. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
And she was so upset that she ran away and said that she would commit suicide if she were forced to leave because she had friends in school, and she felt completely Austrian. She was hidden for a while by a Catholic priest, and someone had written on his wall, his name was Josef Friedel, had written Müller Friedel. And I gathered on the one hand there was an outpouring of sympathy for her and the family, but on the other hand there was great resentment at these foreigners. And I wonder how are attitudes evolving in Austria on this question, because from what I know, Austria has rather severe restrictions on granting citizenship.
Yeah, it was not citizenship itself, it was asylum in her mm-hmm. case. And the case was high in the news. It showed that the Austrian society was very much split because it was not... It was on the one hand, of course, it was this particular case where you were seeing that a girl of this Kosovo Albanian family was so well integrated that she didn't really. I mean, there was the impression that she's from Upper Austria. She was speaking the dialect, the local dialect, and so she was seen by the local population, and they were seen as Austrians. On the other hand. If you go back and see how did they immigrate, they applied for asylum, it was rejected. There were no legal grounds for granting asylum, and it was very obvious that they simply wanted to work in Austria. Now, time has passed, And this is the critical part of the case. Time has passed, and no decision has been taken. And in the meantime, they're very well integrated, of course, and one should try to find a humanitarian solution. I mean, saying that, yes, strictly they are not the criteria fulfilled for granting asylum, but it would be because of the humanitarian situation, useful or advisable to grant them a status of residence and giving them opportunity to stay in Austria. And this came exactly in a situation when the Minister of Interior decided, let's try to stick to the law and let's try to close those cases that are still open. So it was a very I wouldn't say awkward situation, but this happened exactly in a time when there were these two discussions taking place. Now, inside the Austrian population, and this was interesting, they were split. There were the ones saying that law is law, and other ones tried to go in line with the law and have not been granted asylum, had to leave. And other ones, other people are not as obedient and even hide or whatever. So they were more on the official side. And on the other hand, you had a lot of people who were even taking part at demonstrations and trying to raise their voice in order to find a humanitarian solution. So far, there has been no decision taken. She's still in Austria, but it shows very much. I mean, if you talk about asylum, then this is very much a homeland security issue, which where there are very strict laws, very strict regulations, and very strict deadlines, and once all the authorities have taken the decision that asylum cannot be granted, then the decision might easily be negative. And what's the next step? I think asylum is a problem that affects not only Austria, but Austria, and this is what I would like, and this was also mentioned in the New York Times article. Austria is one of those countries where we have, if we compare the size and the per capita number of asylum seekers, we have a lot of asylum seekers. We have many from Russia, many from Chechnya. We have some also from Iraq. But I think the number of positive decisions is also a fact that shows that we're trying to do whatever we can. And the Austrian himself, I would consider him very humanitarian. If you see, for example, how Austrians reacted in the Bosnia crisis, in the Balkan crisis, when there was a war, and Austrians tried to help their neighbors and to help the refugees, there were humanitarian fundraising events on TV, and it showed that Austrians themselves are trying to help them how they can. And inside this village, this psychological reaction was the same. I mean, even the Catholic priest was one example, but also the local population is interviewed. So this shows very much, I think, that what exists in every society, that you have a gap between what the official side decides, but after a very long time, and what the local population sees. But again, this case, I would say, is a case where a decision had been taken too late, and it developed into a humanitarian case. But there are many, many other cases where decisions are taken and asylum is granted. And there are many cases, of course, where asylum cannot be granted because someone doesn't come as a political refugee, but simply because he's looking for work. Hmm.
Those of you who want to ask questions, why don't you go to the microphone, Serena?
I would like to ask a question. That is, in a certain way, a follow-up to what you have been talking about now. I was a little bit surprised that in your description of European Union and the place of Austria in European Union, that you stress so much the economic side. and not the political side. I understand that, of course, this is the history of how the European Union was developed, but what is really very interesting now, when it stopped to be so controversial as it was at the beginning, is how the membership in the European Union changed the political situation inside member countries. For example, if you could tell us how Austria changed, not only economically, as we heard from you, but also politically, what changed in Austria? Austria was a democratic country before, so it wasn't a story like in Poland or in the Czech Republic. Were there a very substantial political changes?
Well, in regard to Austria, no. No, I wouldn't say that there were significant changes. I mean, we had a long discussion before we became a EU member state on whether a neutral country can be a member state. This was, I think, the most important aspect. But politically, I think that there has been, since our state treaty in 1955, a very stable development and always very pro-European. We were members of all the other association programs, but we were not full members of the European Union. And also as United Nations member state and having headquarters and being very active in peacekeeping operations and so on and so on. I think politically it has always been our credo to try to take part in international initiatives, peace building, etc. Therefore, I think that the vote of the Austrians, 67% pro-Europe in favor of EU membership, was very much the expression of this. I think this has not changed Austria significantly. I could imagine that many other countries have had more pro-anti-Europe discussions inside. What I think is important that this development is taking place right now, since we became members and since the last two enlargement rounds. And the changes that are taking place inside the European Union, that this is something that affects Austria and that there is very much discussion on this. But as I try to explain, I see it very much as a win-win situation in many regards. Skepticism is not as high in regard to, for example, the Central and East European enlargement as it could be. So I think that there is very much political consensus. I see it also that inside the parliament, most of the cases, there is very much consensus and has always been very much consensus, except for one or two opposition parties. You always have in political European projects a lot of consensus. I wouldn't see so many changes as to Europe and as to the political implications.
Yes.
I have two points, actually. You talked a lot about the economic side and basically the status quo and how good things are for Europeans, especially Austrians and so forth. What's interesting, though, is you kind of left out what happened 7 years ago when things were a little bit bleak and I would say very embarrassing for Austria in terms of their membership. I'm alluding to the sanctions, EU sanctions against the right-wing government in Austria 7 years ago. That's the one thing. The other thing, what I'm actually more interested in is there such a thing as a European vision beyond economics? That is, when Austria joined the EU in 1995 and before that, just before Austria became an EU member, there was a lot of talk about the European idea, and Austrian intellectuals would allude to Hugo von Hofmannsthal, to Stefan Zweig, and so forth. And there was a lot of enthusiasm in terms of a new European vision and what it means to be European. And also, 4 years ago, Jacques Derrida, Jürgen Habermas, and Umberto Eco wrote articles in European newspapers about, you know, this vision. What is that vision? I don't see anything happening in terms of creating a vision. What does it mean to be European? Does it mean to live in, to be mobile, to move from one place to another? That's nice, but is there an ideological project too? Thank you.
Yeah, as to the first question, I wanted to present more the implications of the EU membership in regard to Austria, and these were particular economic aspects. One of the what happened in 2000 when the government was built, the coalition government, the People's Party government, built a coalition with the right wing Freedom Party of Jörg Haider. If you follow the story of those coalitions and of those right-wing parties, it ended with the fact that the party split away. Then there were new elections, and in the end, Mr. Haider, who was at that time the chief negotiator, is at least as in regards to the politic of the government, the federal government, no longer very relevant. I mean, he's the Carinthian governor, and this is still his function, but it is not he's not playing a decisive role inside the government right now. I mean, this is a new coalition government, a Social Democrat Party. So I think this was a development at that part, at that time. Of course, my experience was also, I mean, I was in that time in Vienna. We had quite a lot of sensitive projects, and the whole situation was completely unexpected, that 14 member states take measures or whatever, sanctions against 15th member state. This is not in line with the spirit of the European Union and with the treaties. It was completely unexpected. I think at that time it was already, it was also not very clear for those who initiated those sanctions what will be the outcome, and there was no outcome scenario clear. And I read several memoirs of ambassadors and of presidents and of also foreign statesmen that really touched upon it, but didn't go into detail, because at that time it was a new situation, but they were not really prepared to handle the situation. And a few months later, there was the same election result in Italy, and they didn't repeat the whole sanction scenario. So, and also the outcome was that three wise men were appointed to evaluate how democratic is Austria, and I think this was basically the end of this of these sanctions. It was not very productive, I would say, for the whole European discussion, because in particular for those countries that were in those days members candidates for becoming member states, they were not really happy with the whole discussion and how a member state can be punished or whatever. So I think this was more counterproductive for the European idea. Anyway, I mean, it ended, and a few months later, everyone was in good terms. So I think it was at that time a little bit of an unexpected situation. What is more critical? What would have been more critical if a right wing, if this government, and this was the government of 2000 and 2006, would have not complied with democratic standards, whatever. But they fully complied with democratic standards, and they and this government had a lot of very very useful projects, and was also active in many other fields, like a very big restitution package for former forced laborers and victims of the Holocaust. And these are things that were negotiated at that time with the U.S. administration. And I think the people involved were very, very committed to this project and also to Europe. And I think that most of the facts showed that the government was then doing a very good job. The second question was as to the mission, the vision. It's interesting because when I grew up, it was the European Community was an economic community, and it was not a union yet. It was at that time it was called the European Community, and what was the most significant fact that in trade issues, it's a competence of the Commission, like WTO issues, etc. And since then, this remained very much a competence of the European Community. And then when they began to negotiate something else and to have this with the Maastricht Treaty, this first idea of the Union and with the pillars, which this model has also evolved, and now with the new treaty, they are no longer the pillars. This is also part of the European Union. But I always had the impression that foreign policy and security policy is something that is a little bit apart, because it's very very hard to find a consensus, and because all EU member states have very individual interests due to their unique history. The history of Austria is one which I mentioned, which had as a very interesting implication, these very close ties to our neighbors. But the history of other countries, for example, Greece in regard to Turkey, or the Baltic states in regard to Russia, or whatever, has also certain implications. And that it's. I think that in certain European questions, it will end up that certain EU member states have their particular views. This is one aspect which was always very interesting for me as a diplomat, that that finding foreign security policy which is European is something very hard. We have those meetings, we have those council meetings, we have those expert meetings, and we have joint positions. But there were many, many situations and where individual EU member states took individual decisions, for example, Iraq. The idea of something, of a joint cultural heritage or something like this, I heard this very often in discussions, also with diplomats, and there, I think in the end you will find something like a European heritage, and like something that is a link or a link between many countries in Europe, which goes back to the 19th century, where the European concert existed, and there were six main powers, and they were in close contact, and they took decisions on what happens basically in Europe. And I think this spirit exists in some meetings. I have felt it. It is very interesting if you go to St. Petersburg and Putin is.
Yes, I'd like to continue to take advantage of your having been in Moscow and watch these things from a Russian perspective. And I'd like to go back to the enlargement prospect. And one question is, should it include Russia? You've described the European elements of the Russian tradition. The other question is the fact that Russia is becoming more authoritarian again, and you were there while it was happening. Doesn't that make it important to extend the enlargement prospect or activate the enlargement prospect for Russia's and Europe's neighbors? In other words, for Ukraine, or for Belarus, for Moldova. I mean, doesn't that give it an urgency that it might not have had when Russia was under Yeltsin?
Yeah. I have followed this discussion since 2003, and of course, Ukraine is a very interesting country. I mean, this is a very large country, second Slavic country, and it is it has historic ties with Russia, but on the other hand, there were also historic problems. And what happened in 2004 with the presidential elections and Yushchenko's victory. Was that for Russia? This was a very unexpected situation, and the same happened in Georgia, and what is interesting is that that Russia is very much trying to maintain certain certain ties and links to those countries that were not only part of the Soviet Union, but also has there are many other historic ties with them, and with whom they are. They have very close connections also in regard to business, for example, or economic cooperation. For example, the airplane production is something that is a joint airplane production, the Ukrainian and the Russian. What is interesting is how did they react in regard to the question, should Ukraine or Georgia become a NATO country, and in particular, should Ukraine or Moldova, for example, become a EU member country. I think it's not only what others might think, but I think it applies the same as to Turkey, as to other member countries, that of course integration into the European Union is a very long process, and you have to fulfill a lot of criteria. For the European Union in particular, I mean, if you look at the dimensions and look at the map and see the size of Ukraine and see the size of Europe, I mean, this is a very large country. So this would be really a big challenge. What is interesting is, of course, how to improve the cooperation with those countries and how to develop closer ties. And for this, we have the European Neighbourhood Policy. This is quite an efficient instrument. We can develop cooperation and even build up trade unions, etc. We can develop a very close cooperation and as soon and as quickly as possible. Whereas the perspective of a European membership perspective is something different. I mean, this is a long process. Therefore, I think whatever we can do right now to promote democratic development, to promote market economy, we should do it, and we are doing it. There are many funds, many programs that have exactly this purpose. The other thing is, of course, as to Ukraine, is the question whether the Ukrainians themselves would like to become members of the European Union. This is also an interesting question. The opinion polls gave several pictures. One of the last was when I left, was that definitely there was not very much in favor of NATO. And as to EU, they were neither more neutral, I would say. Perhaps also due to the fact that they're not really aware what the EU is. I mean, NATO is very well known, but the EU is not as well known. But again, I think that what we can do in regard to those countries is what we're doing with the European Neighbourhood Policy. And this is also one of the side aspects that whenever we meet other partners, third countries, in particular human rights situations in many other countries or energy problems or whatever, Middle East peace process, but also Russia, Ukraine, or those countries are on the agenda when we meet, when there are EU-USA, for example, transatlantic meetings. This is part of the agenda, and we discuss it. And therefore, I think that for Europe, this is a very important, since these are very important partners. But I wouldn't say that becoming a EU member state is a short-term perspective that is realistic and advisable and would really have a benefit for both sides.
I'm going to ask one more question. What would be the Austrian view of how the U.S. attitudes toward the European Union ought to change? What would Austria want from a new U.S. president in regard to the European Union?
Well, it's interesting because I was sometimes asking the same question to my American friends and asking what will change, and I think what is very important for us is that is this commitment to this transatlantic partnership and friendship, and which, as I see, goes back to the 40s and 50s when European countries received a lot of aid for reconstruction development, And this is a friendship, and this is a partnership. And what we have now with the transatlantic partnership and the transatlantic dialogue, this is, of course, a very important institutionalized partnership. But basically, every European statesman wants to have is that in basic projects, like, for example, how can we combat climate change? This is one of the issues that has been on many agendas, also G8 and international agendas, now United Nations, or certain humanitarian crises like Darfur. How can we really cooperate and act together? And all other international problems that exist in the Middle East, particularly also in regard to Iran and other countries. I mean, these are areas where we want to cooperate, of course. And I think this cooperation in regards to combating international terrorism is one area where there is an absolute consensus that we have to cooperate. But I think that whenever an administration, a president is promoting cooperation in many areas, also in particular, just to mention one example which was high in the news, and climate change and others, and when we can really try to find joint answers to many problems, this is the best approach.
All right. Well, thank you all, and thank you very much.
This is WDUR. You've been listening to a discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled Getting to Know the European Union, Austria. Speaking was Dr. Wolfgang Rennesetter, director of the Austrian Press and Information Service at the Embassy of Austria. Moderating tonight's discussion was Alan Berger, senior editorial writer for the Boston Globe. We began with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences executive director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Michael Garth and Mike Toda with help from Rachel Paste. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.